The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, titled The Baalei Tosfos and the Return to the Land of Israel, is dedicated to the honor and merit of Riva Bas Yosef, Mrs. Roberta Scher, and to the memory of Ilui Nishmos, Ritzvi Hirsch ben Avram Yitzchak Olav HaShalom, Rivka Bas ben Yaman Olav HaShalom, Mr. and Mrs. Harry and Rebecca Stein of blessed memory, and to the memory of Ilui Nishmas, Ravram Abba Rebetzal Olav HaShalom, Rabbi Avram Abba Friedman of blessed memory.
In the relatively tranquil decades following the First Crusade, Jewish life not only recovered from the trauma of the Crusade, but also flourished. The towns of the Rhineland, Mainz, Speyer, Cologne, once again became major Jewish centers, producing great scholars and great literary works. During this period, however, Germany soon became eclipsed by northern France, which in the years following the First Crusade developed into the leading spiritual and intellectual center of Ashkenazic Jewry, producing such luminaries as the Rashbam, Rabbeinu Tam, and their famous disciples, the topic of the previous lecture. But this relative calm was only short-lived. Because of the fall of the Crusader Kingdom in Edessa, Armenia, in the year 1146, Pope Eugenius III called upon King Louis VII of France and King Conrad III of Germany and all of their subjects to take up the cause of the cross. In order to create enthusiasm for the project, the Pope asked his former mentor, Bernard of Clairvaux, the abbot of the Cistercian Monastery of Clairvaux, France, and one of the most influential figures of that time is the famed Saint Bernard. The dog is named. To assist him in organizing the crusade, which he did with great success. As the movement grew and gained enthusiasts, however, its direction increasingly turned against the Jews. Peter the Venerable, the much-respected abbot of Cluny, France, for example, openly assailed the commercial honesty of the Jews and demanded that the Jewish wealth be expropriated and channeled to support the Crusades. In the Rhineland, the movement grew even more hostile, largely due to the preaching of a Cistercian monk by the name of Radulf, Raoul. Riots broke out and many Jews were killed. At the request of the archbishops of Cologne and Mainz, Bernard of Clairvaux was asked to come and help quell the anti-Jewish riots. Bernard came to the Rhineland and recalled Radulf. He also condemned the spilling of Jewish blood. His justification, however, was based on the Church's doctrine, which was first expressed by Pope Gregory I in the 7th century, that the Jews have to be kept alive in an inferior position in order for them to eventually repent and embrace the love and compassion of Christianity. Due to Bernard's influence, and also to the great measures of protection taken by the Jewish populace, the Second Crusade resulted in far fewer Jewish casualties than the first. Rabbi Ephraim of Bonn, one of the great Talmudists and liturgists of the 12th century, an eyewitness to much of the Jewish suffering during the Second Crusade, wrote Sefer HaZechira, a detailed account of those events. The following, which are in our notes, are highlights of Rabbi Ephraim's account. We'll start on the first page and we'll read this together. It's really quite short, but it's really a classic. I culled the highlights. Let this be recorded for later generations to praise and magnify Almighty God. For Satan came to Ashdod. This is a play on words. Ashdod is a city, of course, on the coast of Israel. But it's also similar to the word shodad, which means to plunder and pillage. To pillage Israel and Judah. The enemy traveled in large groups and camped in Harodah. Harodah, again, is also a play on words. Harodah is a city, was mentioned, again, one of the encampments as the Jews travel through the desert in Parshas Maaseh. But it's also a play on Harodah means trembling and fear. This occurred in the year 4906, this is 1146, when our adversaries came and oppressed Israel. For Radulf was wicked and he treacherously persecuted the Jews. Radulf, the priest of idolatry. Again, this just reflects the predominant opinion amongst Jews that the Christianity was a form of idolatry because of the belief in the Trinity. Arose against the nation of God to destroy, slay, and annihilate them, just as wicked Haman had attempted to do. He set forth from France and traveled across the entire land of Germany. May God spare the Jewish community there. And to seek out and contaminate the Christians with the horizontal and vertical sign, and there's the sign of the cross. He went along barking and was named Barker, summoning all the name of Yeshu to go to Jerusalem to war against Yishmael. Wherever he went, he spoke evil of the Jews of the land and incited the snake and dogs against us, saying, quote, which was familiar in our studies of the First Crusade, avenge the crucified ones upon his enemies who stand before you, then go to war against the Ishmaelites. In other words, you have the white, you're fighting the enemy, you're going traveling all the way to Israel. You have the enemy here, the Jews. And it continues on, Ephraim of Bun. Upon hearing this, our hearts melted and our spirit failed us because of the fury of the oppressor who intended to destroy us. We cried out to our God, saying, quote, alas, God, not even 50 years, again, this is a question of the numbering, for this basically it was 50 years, the number of years of a jubilee have passed since our blood was shed in witness to the oneness of your reverend name on the day of the great slaughter. Will you forsake us eternally, O Lord? Will you extend your anger to all generations? Do not permit this suffering to recur. End quote. The Lord heard our outcry, and he turned to us and had mercy upon us. In his great mercy and grace, he sent a decent priest. It's interesting how Ephraim looked. This one honored and respected by all the clergy in France, named Abbe, unless he was an abbot, Bernard of Clairvaux, to deal with this evil person. Bernard, too, spoke raucously, as in their manner. This is what he said to them. It is good that you go against the Ishmaelites, but whosoever touches a Jew to take his life is like one who harms Yeshu himself. My disciple Radulf, who has spoken about annihilating the Jews, has spoken in error. From the book of Psalms it is written of them, slay them not, lest my people forget. Again, this is part of their misinterpretation of the verse. Not to slay the Jews, but they will always remain as a witness. You know, because they're suffering, in other words, is because of their rejection of Yeshua. All the Gentiles regarded this priest as one of their saints. He was eventually, says he, after his death, Saint Bernard was officially sainted. We've not inquired whether he was receiving payment for speaking on behalf of Israel. In other words, he wasn't sure that perhaps it was also because what was regularly done was there were substantial bribes given to the clergy. And he wasn't sure if that was the case in the situation. When our enemies heard his words, many of them ceased plotting to kill us. We also gave our wealth as ransom for our lives. This was given, of course, to the archbishops of the communities, the heads of the Lord, being merciful to us, permitted a remnant to survive on earth and enabled us to remain alive. Whatever they asked of us, either silver or gold, we did not withhold from them. Were it not for the mercy of our Creator in sending the aforementioned Abbe and his later epistles, and after he had left, he still sent letters, no remnant or vestige would have remained of Israel. Blessed be the Redeemer and Savior. Blessed, Baruch Shemoy, blessed be his name. But he goes on to say that there were casualties of this Second Crusade, Jewish casualties. A Jewish woman by name Mistress Min of Spire left the city, and they seized her and cut off her ears and the thumbs of her hands. Thus did she suffer for the sanctification of her Creator. They did this because she refused to convert. Happy is the people whose lot is thus. Happy is the people whose God is the Lord. And he continues on, after the Festival of Tabernacles in the year 4906, and it would seem that, as the scholar said, perhaps there's an error, it's 4907, because this really all happened in the year 1146. They departed from the cities and made their way to the fortresses. In other words, the Jews were afraid of the of what was occurring, and this again, despite the efforts of Bernard. The majority of the community of Cologne gave a large sum to the Bishop of Cologne, and evidently it's clear all was done with considerable payment, so that he would give them the fortress of Wolkenberg. This was the securest refuge in Lorraine. Lorraine is the area immediately to the west of the Rhine. They gave the nobleman, keeper of the fort, many gifts so that he would leave the fort and hand it over to them alone. No stranger or uncircumcised one was allowed to join them. They were afraid that what had happened in the First Crusade, that they would be betrayed by the by the non-Jews inside the fortress. So they wanted to make sure that there would only be Jews and be no betrayal. And he continues on, they all pledged their lives and their homes and wealth in the city of Cologne to the bishop as collateral.
From the time the Gentiles were informed that Wolkenberg had been given to the Jews and that they were gathering there, they ceased pursuing them, and thus relief came for all the rest of the Jews who were fleeing to the castles. I, the young author of this narrative, was 13 years old when I dwelled with my kinsmen in the fortress of Wolkenberg. Most of them were related to my mother, may her soul rest in Eden. The other Jews of all the king's provinces gathered together and rose in defense of their lives. They saved themselves and their families by seeking refuge in the fortresses of Gentile acquaintances. In other words, a very large number of them gathered in this fortress in Wolkenberg, and the others gathered in other areas which were fortified throughout the kingdom. And it continues on, other Jews too were seized and were forcibly defiled with the disgusting water, describing baptism. They escaped, however, and were saved, and that very night they fled and returned to their Lord, the Holy One of Israel. A Jewish woman by the name of Gutalda of blessed memory was seized at Aschaffenburg, but she refused to be profaned with the bitter accursed water. She sanctified the holy name and drowned herself in the river. May God remember her for good. And it continues on in the Sefer Zechira. On the 22nd day of the month of Adar, the evildoers attacked the community of Würzburg. For the other communities had already fled to the rocks and fortresses. The inhabitants of Würzburg had anticipated living in tranquility, but instead they endured distress and destruction. The enemy made false accusations in order to justify their attacks upon them. They declared, quote, "We have found a Gentile in the river whom you slew and threw there. He had thus achieved sainthood and is working miracles." As we will discuss throughout the lecture, this problem of this false accusation stayed with the Jews for many, many years. As a result, the Sefer Zechira continues, the errant ones in the poorest segment of the population, those who derived joy from things of no consequence, arose and smote the Jews. A saintly person named Rabbi Isaac, son of our Rabbi Eliyakim, a modest and humble man, venerable and pleasant, was slain over his book. And there were 21 others with him. On the following day, the bishop ordered that all the slaughtered saints be collected on wagons, all the choice severed limbs hips and shoulders, thumbs of hands and feet, sanctified with holy oil, together with everything else that remained of their bodies and limbs, and buried in his garden. It gives you an inkling of what happened at the slaughter. Chizkiyo, son of our master Rebbe Eliakim, and mistress Yehudis, his wife, purchased this Garden of Eden from the bishop and consecrated it as an internal burial ground. Quote, "May the generous one be blessed for his bountifulness for having given," end quote. And it continues on, also in Ham, it's not clear among scholars where that city is, about 150 people were slain. May God remember them for good. In Corinthian 2, and again there's a question about the identity of this area, countless people were slain, for they had gathered together in one courtyard, and the enemy came upon them suddenly. There were two young men, valiant brothers, who stood in defense of their own lives and those of their brethren. They slew and wounded their enemies, and the foe could not prevail against them, till the enemy came upon them from the rear into the courtyard and slew all of them. Rabbeinu Petter, the great rabbi, disciple of our master, Rabbi Shmuel, Rashbam, and his brother, our master, Rabbi Yaakov of Ramaru, referring to Rabbeinu Tam, was slain as he marched in a funeral procession of a deceased Parnas. Parnas is the head of the community. Woe to the generation that has lost so precious a pearl. In the previous lecture, we've already described how Rabbeinu Tam's house was pillaged and he was almost killed by crusaders. It was also described in Sefer Zechira. And it continues on, those who have been forcibly converted in the various communities return to the true path in the same year, 4907. That's 1147. Blessed be he who grants strength, who provided a priest, this amazing story, who guided them to the land of France and other lands so that they might return to their Torah and remain in those places until their defilement had worn off and been forgotten. For this he took neither silver nor gold. Blessed be he who performs miracles for all who trust in him and draws near to him. This is a very important point, but because according to church law, and this was first promulgated by Pope Gregory I in the 7th century, Jews were not allowed technically to be forcibly converted, but if they were, they were forced by church law to remain within the church. And as a result, an incident such as this was very rare, especially that a priest would do this on his own and take the Jews to an area where the church was not aware that they had been converted, so they would be able to remain as Jews. And he concludes in the Sefer Zechira, on the 15th of Av, in the year 4907, all the communities had already returned to their native lands and dwelt in their cities and in their homes as before. The errant ones, referring to the crusaders, had already passed through and were headed toward Tophis and Gehenna, referring to purgatory, hell. Blessed be the God who wreaks vengeance, for most have never returned to their homes, nor do their communities ever see them again. Some of them died of starvation, some by the plague or sword, and some from the exhaustion of the sea crossing. Furthermore, the hand of the Lord was upon any evildoers who had laid a hand upon a Jew. Only a small number of the murderers, not even one out of 100, ever returned to their homeland. As we pointed out when we just read the account of the riots in Würzburg, the Jews were not only being accused of the crimes of their forefathers, they killed Yeshu, but they were now viewed as dangerous murderers who killed Christians. It is ironic that the same accusation, ritual killing, was originally made against Christians during the early part of the first millennium. There they accused Christians of killing pagan children and drinking their blood. Such early church fathers as Tertullian and Eusebius spent much effort in proving the other falsehood of the accusation. This accusation was first made against Jews in the year 1144 in the city of Norwich, England. There a child by the name of William was found missing, and a Jewish apostate by the name of Theobald of Cambridge came forward and testified that it was customary for the Jews of Europe to come together and draw lots every year to kill a Christian child and sacrifice him on the holiday of Passover. I mean, this is so amazing that if it didn't lead to tragedy, it would be hilarious. Last year, Theobald said, was held in Narbona. And this year, the lot fell on Norwich. When the boy's body was found, however, there was no evidence of sacrifice or murder. In fact, there seems to have been evidence that the child merely fainted and his relatives mistakenly buried him alive. The church, however, treated William as if he were a sainted martyr. His remains were buried in a memorial chapel, which became a shrine, bringing pilgrims, offerings, and much-needed revenue to the church. Although no individual Jew was accused or directly suffered, Theobald's testimony laid the groundwork for further such accusations. This is what a contemporary chronicler wrote about William of Norwich. Quote, "The Jews of Norwich bought a Christian child before Easter." Note, he said he bought him, as if he was sold, he was kidnapped, or the parents sold him, "and tortured him with all the tortures wherewith our Lord was tortured, and on Long Friday," probably meaning Good Friday, "hanged him on a rod in hatred of our Lord, and afterwards buried him." In the year 1171, such an accusation resurfaced again on the 20th of Sivan of that year in the city of Blois, France, as 48 Jews, including 17 women, were burned to death because of this hideous blood libel. This was unfortunately only a portent of more things to come. For up until the 20th century, untold numbers of Jews lost their lives undergoing the most excruciating tortures due to this terrible libel. At the behest of Rabbeinu Tam, less than 2 weeks before his death, all of northern France and England accepted upon themselves that date, the 20th of Sivan, as a fast day. In the words of Rabbeinu Tam, "Godol yiat soim hazeh mitsoim gedalia." This fast day, the 20th of Sivan, should be considered a greater fast day than Soim Gedalia, the fast commemorating the tragic death of Gedalia ben Achikam and the final dispersion of the Jews from Israel. Ki Yom Kippurim hu, for this is a day of atonement. Evidently he understood that the death of these martyrs atoned for the sins of the generation. By the way, this fast day was observed by Ashkenazic communities for many hundreds of years up until modern times. The blood libel seems to have had other terrible effects. Philip Augustus II, King of France, ardently believed in the myth of Jewish ritual killing. In fact, according to a few accounts, he actually believed that Jews eat Christians. As a result, in 1181, a year after he came to power, he had the Jews of Paris arrested and their property confiscated. In 1182, he had all the Jews banished from Île-de-France, the territory controlled, which was Paris and the surrounding area. The rest of what is today France was controlled by the King of England and by other overlords. Although Philip let the Jews return in 1198, the Jews suffered greatly under his reign, as well as in the reign of his successors, Louis VIII, who ruled from 1223 to 1226, and Louis IX, commonly known as St. Louis, who ruled from 1226 to 1270. Finally, in the year 1306, Philip IV, commonly known as Philip le Bel, or the Fair, banished all of the Jews from his kingdom, which as a result of many conquests now encompass a large segment of modern-day France. Although they were allowed to return, in the year 1315, under successor Louis X, in only 7 years, in the year 1322, they were again expelled. As a result of a large bribe, in 1359 the Jews again were allowed to return. Of course, this was a much smaller group of Jews. But in 1394 they were expelled for good. Many hundreds of years would pass before Jews would again be allowed in France. Historians point out that besides the increasing militancy of Christianity and its hatred towards Jews, there was an additional historical factor as to why the Jews began to suffer so during this period. The reason that the governments of France, Germany, and England initially invited the Jews to their realms and offered them economic opportunity and protection was because the Jews first served an important function in society. They were originally Europe's bankers and major merchants. As urban society developed and commerce expanded, especially after the beginning of the Crusades, there was much less need for Jews and their expertise. In fact, the Christian burghers viewed them as foreign competition, and together with unrelenting pressure from the church, the secular authorities were much more reluctant than in the past to protect their Jews. This despite the fact that Jews were a tremendous source of income for the royal and noble powers, as they were taxed considerably more than the population as a whole. In the year 1187, almost all of Palestine, including Jerusalem, was conquered by the Egyptian Sultan Saladin. As a result, Pope Gregory VIII and his successor, Pope Clement III, called for a third crusade. The leaders of this crusade were to be the most powerful monarchs of Europe: Richard I of England, commonly known as Richard the Lionheart, Philip II, Augustus of France, and the German King and Holy Roman Emperor, Frederick I, Barbarossa. Frederick drowned in 1190 in Turkey before he reached Palestine. Although Richard and Philip successfully conquered Acre, on the northern coast, and Richard subsequently captured the other ports which were south of Acre, Haifa, Caesarea, Arsuf, and Jaffa, he was not able to recapture Jerusalem. All he managed to do was to have the Muslims sign a treaty allowing the pilgrims to visit the Church of the Holy Sepulchre without harm. Due to his efforts, however, the European power still had a presence in Palestine for yet another century. By the year 1291, however, all of Palestine had been reconquered by the Muslims, and the last remnant of the Crusaders left Eretz Yisrael. Europeans were not to return until the First World War. The Third Crusade, like the two that preceded it, caused untold suffering to the Jewish community. Jews in England were taxed at an enormous rate to supply funding for the Crusades, and later were the subjects of vicious anti-Semitic riots that left countless dead, including the Baal Tosfos and disciple of Rabbeinu Tam, Rav Yaakov of Orleans. The Jews of York, under the leadership of another Baal Tosfos and disciple of Rabbeinu Tam, Rabbeinu Yom Tov of Yoani, committed mass suicide to avoid baptism. This we will discuss in greater detail in the following lecture. Others were martyred at that time in France and Germany. But martyrdom was not confined to the Crusades. For instance, one of the great Baalei Tosfos, whose comments are widely quoted, Rabbeinu Elchanan, who was the son of the Ri HaZoken of Dampir, was martyred in the year 1184. It is truly amazing that despite all of the persecutions and expulsions, scholarship of the highest level was able to flourish. After the death of the Ri HaZoken, in approximately the year 1200, the mantle of leadership in Dampir fell on the shoulders of Yitzchok ben Avrom, a grandson of Shimshon ben Yosef of Falej, a respected colleague of Rabbeinu Tam. Since both of their names were Yitzchok, the disciple is referred to as Ritzbo, the acronym for Yitzchok ben Avrom, or Ri HaBocher, he is called, Ri the Younger, in contrast to his master and predecessor, Ri HaZoken, Ri the Elder. While he was younger, Ritzbo, Yitzchok ben Avrom, studied under Rabbeinu Tam. Later, he studied under Ri HaZoken. He is widely quoted in the Tosfos commentary throughout the Talmud. Indirectly, the Ritzvot was responsible for spreading the teaching of Tosfos to Provence in southern France and eventually to Spain, where it was not only studied but also used as a basis for a whole new system of analysis and understanding. Among the Ritzvot's disciples were Rav Nosson ben Meir of Trinquetel, Rav Yehuda ben Yochar, both of Provence, and both teachers of the Ramban, Moshe ben Nachman, who expanded upon the teachings of Tosfos, creating a whole new school of thought. This was in turn transmitted to the Ramban's great disciples, Rav Shlomo ben Aderes, known as the Rajba, and Rav Aaron Halevi of Barcelona, known as the Ra'o. In your notes, we quote from the Ramban's Drasha, his discourse, that he gave when he was in Israel, in Eretz Yisrael, it would seem to be in the city of Akko, to the yeshiva that was composed of former members of the yeshivas in France, the Bali Tosfos. And addressing them, he said, quote, this is from his drasha that he gave on Rosh Hashanah, I heard directly from my master, Rav Nosson ben Rav Meir, this is, we said, Rav Nosson ben Meir of Trinquetel, that when he first came to learn Torah before Rav Yitzchak ben Rav Avram, Ritzva, the blower of the shofar blew four shvorim. In other words, we know the different sounds of the shofar. There's the long sound, the tkia. There's the shorter sounds called shvorim, and the staccato sound called the trua. There are three shvorim blown. What happens when one blows a fourth? That was the discussion. And Rabbi Yitzchak said to him, and now he's quoting, he quoted that incident, which is recorded in the Drasha. What basically he said was that having more shivorim did not invalidate the process. We quote here on the top of page 4, in the Sefer Orchos Chaim and Hilchos Leil Pesach, the Ramban wrote, quote, I received from my master Rabbeinu Yehuda, this is Yehuda ben Yochar, who received this from his master Rabbeinu Yitzchak bar Avram Ritzba of France. So here I'm just showing you how the teachings that started in northern France made their way to Provence and finally to Spain. In addition, amongst Ritzba's disciples were of Moshe and Rav Shmuel ben Shneir of Evrel, who along with their brother Rav Yitzchak created their own yeshiva in Chateau Thierry in Normandy, France. As Normandy was a distinct entity then. It's in northwest France, but was not controlled by the King of France. Amongst their disciples was Rabbeinu Yonah of Gerona, the cousin and close colleague of the Ramban. Rabbeinu Yonah's greatest disciple was the Rashba of Shlomo ben Aderes, who after his death went on to study under Ramban. In addition, Rabbeinu Peretz of Korbel, the author of the Tosfos Rabbeinu Peretz, which is on many tractates of the Talmud, Rabbeinu Yitzchak of Korbel, the author of the Smak, the Sefer Mitzvos Ketanos, a compendium of mitzvahs that apply in our time, were students of Rav Moshe and Rav Shmuel of Evrel. In your notes, we quote various passages where they're quoted. And the first one, again, in the drasha, in the discourse the Ramban delivered to the scholars, the French scholars who were living in Acre, he said the following: I presented this matter, and as he had an idea which he wanted presented, and he presented it to the rabbis of France, Rav Moshe ben Rav Shneir, and his brother Rav Shmuel of Evrel, and to Rav Yechiel in Paris, we will discuss a few minutes, through my relative, Arav Rav Yonah, who studied there. In other words, Rabbeinu Yonah studied under these great Rosh Yeshivas in France, and through Rabbeinu Yonah, Ramban was able really to communicate to them. On page 4 of our notes, we quote various Tosfos throughout Shas, where these brothers are mentioned. I would first quote in Brachos. This again is only a sampling in Mevavim Beis. Rav Moshe Mevro, Rav Shmuel Mevro is quoted in Masechet Kedushin and Tosfos, Rav Zayin Beis in 27b. We quote here in note 4. This is taken really from the Tur Yoredeya, where Rav Shmuel Mevro quotes in the name of his Rebbe Ritzbo regarding a certain question about the kashrus of an animal where there's a wound and there's a question of healing. Most interesting is the quotation number 5. We all know, for instance, when we sit in a sukkah, first day of sukkahs, we make the bracha of Shechiyonu. And we thank Hashem that He's enabled us to reach this point in time. When we sit again on the second day, on the second night, when we make Kiddush in the sukkah, we again make the Shechiyonu. Because we today, even though we know when the exact time of the first day comes out, but we act as if we were thrust back in time in the period when Jews outside of Israel were not aware of the exact calculation of the calendar and therefore had an extra day. Even after it became known, the fixing of the calendar, the Jews outside of Israel were commanded to maintain the 2 days. This was a, as the Talmud explains, the Gemara in Beis and Dalet Amud Beis in 4b, as a precautionary measure, lest they again forget or circumstances are created that they are actually not aware of the exact day. As a result, the lands outside of Israel, throughout the holidays, we keep 2 days. And normally, therefore, when we make a Shechiyonu, there are 2 days of Shechiyonus. On the first night of Passover, we make a Shechiyonu, and the second night. One exception is taking the lulav. We take the lulav on the first day, we make a Shechiyonu, but on the second day, we do not. And the reason for this is that the bracha of the Shechiyonu was actually designed on a lulav, not necessarily from the time you pick it up, but from the time you prepare it to be picked up, when you tie it together, as you take the various the hodos, you take the myrtle and you take the arova, the willow with the lulav, with the branch of the date palm, and you bind them together. At that point, in preparation, we are allowed to say Shechiyonu. But as the Talmud points out, we delay this and we do it when we actually pick up the lulav. The reasoning, however, that we don't make a second Shechiyonu is that even if pretending that we were at a time when we were not sure of the calendar and we had made a mistake and we picked it up was not truly the first day, the Shechiyonu would not be in vain because we could start making a Shechiyonu as soon as we bound the lulav. So in any case, the time has begun to say Shechiyonu, and there's no need to make a second Shechiyonu, and therefore we pick it up the second day, we don't make a Shechiyonu. That reasoning was not universally held, however. And as we quote here, and this is on note number 5 on page 4, Miu Shemaiti Memer Rishmol Me'ivro, that Rabbeinu Peretz, his disciple, quotes in the name of his Rebbe, Rebbe Shmuel of Ivro, so that if the first day of Sukkot comes out in the weekday, well, you don't. And when it comes out on Shabbos, then the second day is the first time you take a lulav, you make a Shechiyonu. But when it comes out on the weekday, you've already made a Shechiyonu. He maintained that you still have to make another Shechiyonu on the second day. He says, Lo yotze bicha Shechiyonu sheberach b'yom rishon, b'lulav. He did not fulfill the mitzvah because he maintained that you just can't say it in the middle of the period. Either it has to be the time you actually put the lulav together or the time when you pick it up to be yotze to fulfill the mitzvah. In the middle, it's in a sense in a limbo. And therefore, you haven't fulfilled the mitzvah if it is in the middle. And therefore, since we outside of Israel acting as if we truly did not know which day it is, and there's a possibility in that framework that the first day would not be the true day, well, it's not the time to say Shechiyam, because it's not the Shas Asiyah, not the time you make it, nor is it the Shas Netila, time of taking. And that is the opinion of Shmuel Meivra. We don't rule like this, but it is a fascinating opinion. And again, as I say, we'd like to bring, as we can, the teachings that impact on our own lives in the sense that they shouldn't be just names, but we should attach them with real ideas and teachings. Rav Yitzchok Bar Shner is also mentioned as a Tosfos in Tamur, we quote in note 6 in the Chesam et Aleph. He's quoted in the Kobo, here's a note 7. And the Tosfos that were created by that yeshiva are called Shitas Me'ivro. As we quote on note 8. Just in conclusion with this section, you notice on note 11, Ram Bar Shner, or Moshe Bar Shner, is quoted by the Ritva. The Ritva, who was from Seville in Spain, was a disciple of the Ra'o, Rav Aaron of Barcelona, who was a disciple of Ramban, who in turn says through Rabbeinu Yonah, his cousin, was able to access the teachings of Ram Bar Shner, Rav Moshe Bar Shner. And the last citation here, number C on page 5, just states the statement of the Ramban from his prologue to Dina de Garmi, his work about indirect damages, where he says, Chachmei Tzarfasim heim amoyrim v'heim amalamdim lonu kol nitmon. The scholars of France are our guides and our teachers for all hidden things. But even more famous than Rav Yitzchok ben Avram was his younger brother, Rav Shimshon ben Avram, quoted throughout the Talmud by the Bali Tosfos and known by his acronym, Rashba, Rav Shimshon ben Avram. He is not to be confused with the later Spanish scholar, Rashba, Rav Shlomo ben Aderes, who lived as 100 years. They were separated, you know, by generations. Rav Shimshon was also known as the Rosh Mishantz, as Rav Shimshon had a yeshiva in Sens in Shantz, France. Like his older brother, Rav Shimshon studied in his younger years under Rabbeinu Tam, and we quote here on page 5, you notice on section 3A, note 1, a story that he quotes from his Rebbe, Rabbeinu Tam. Later on, as Rabbeinu Shimshon studied under Rabbi Yitzchok of Dampir, the Ri Hazokin. For the most part, it was Rabbi Shimshon's Tosfos, his analytical additions to Rashi's commentary, that became the standard Tosfos commentary. In some tractates, Rabbi Shimshon's original Tosfos, which are based upon the Tosfos of his master, the Ri, are those that are printed on the side of the Talmud. For instance, in the tractates Rosh Hashanah and Sukkah, there clearly, it seems, to be Rabbeinu Shimshon's Tosfos. Many of the others are a shortened version of Rav Shimshon's original Tosfos, with additions from later Bali Tosfos, such as the rabbis of Evra and other scholars. This reworked version was created by Rav Eliezer of Tuk in Normandy, France. In addition, Rabbeinu Shimshon wrote commentaries to two of the orders of the Mishnah, which are for the most part, which contain almost no Talmud. This is Zeroyim, which deals with the laws of agriculture, and Taras, of ritual purity. Written in the style of the Tosfos, these commentaries make extensive and invaluable use of the Talmud Yerushalmi and Tosefta, explaining and elucidating difficult passages. Besides the Tosfos, and the commentaries to Zeroyim and Taras, a commentary to the halachic midrash on Leviticus, Torah's Kohanim, is attributed to Rabbeinu Shimshon. Just in our notes, if you notice, on numbers 2 and 3, you know, we explain the high regard that Rabbeinu Shimshon has held. On number 2, we find the Rosh, will be a subject of a future lecture, one of the leading rabbis of both uniquely Germany and Spain, quotes how reliable the Tosfos of Rabbeinu Shimshon are. And in note 3, he notes is the Rabbeinu Tam, referring to the Rihazoken, for Rabbeinu Shimshon are the sources for Rov Torah Seinu. So the greatest bulk of our Torah is through these scholars. We had previously discussed the deteriorating conditions of Jews in France and England. Although Jews were allowed to resettle Paris in the year 1198, it seems that their conditions were steadily worsening. Due to hostilities against Jews in France and England, in the year 1211, shortly after the death of Rav Yitzchak ben Avram, Rav Shimshon of Shantz, together with 300 other scholars, Bali Tosfos, and their families, decided to emigrate to Eretz Yisrael. Although the land of Israel had produced great Rosh Yeshiva and Talmudic and biblical scholars throughout the Gaonic era, by the year 1211, the land was already decimated, a mere outpost of Jews in the Middle East. In fact, from the very beginning of the second millennium, Eretz Yisrael became the victim of wars, persecution, and repeated catastrophic earthquakes. In 1071, almost 30 years before the Crusaders conquered the city of Jerusalem and murdered its entire Jewish populace, the Jewish community in Eretz Yisrael nearly became decimated as the Seljuk Turks conquered and pillaged the land. It was at that time that the Yeshiva of Yerushalayim moved to Tyre, Tzor, in what is now Lebanon, and was functioning until its conquest by the Crusaders. This Aliyah, of Rabbeinu Shimshon, however, marked a turning point in the fortunes of Eretz Yisrael. From that time on, Eretz Yisrael once again became a center of Torah scholarship, a place the great men would long to settle and join the ranks of the Talmid HaChomim, Hasidim, and Anshe Maisa that made up its populace. In the year 1216, Rav Yehud al-Harizi, the famous Spanish translator and poet, began his travels throughout the Middle East. His classic poetic work, Tachkamuni, he describes the people and places that he visited. Al-Harizi mentions two brothers who headed the community of Yerushalayim at the time. One was Rav Meir Barav Boruch, and the other was his brother, the Baal Tosfos Rav Yosef Barav Boruch. Rav Yosef is better known, however, as Rav Yosef Ish Yerushalayim. And we quote here on notes on page 5, where he is quoted, again, Rav Yosef Ish Yerushalayim throughout the Talmud, the Tosfos, in Megillah, and Kedushin, in Psochim. In one place, in Tosfos and Shavuos, in Mem Vav Amud Aleph, is he quoted with his name, just Rav Yosef or Baruch. It would seem that the fact that the Tosfos quoted Rav Yosef, and it seems as being the Ish Yerushalayim, that his teachings made their way from Eretz Yisrael back to France, and later became incorporated in the writings of the Tosfos. After the exodus of Rabbeinu Shimshon, the mantle of leadership fell upon the shoulders of Rav Yehuda ben Yitzchok, a direct descendant of Rashi, through Rashi's son-in-law, Rav Yehuda ben Nosson, the Rivon. Rav Yehuda ben Yitzchok was also the nephew of his master, of Yitzchok HaZoken, of Dampir. Rav Yehuda's paternal aunt, his father's sister, was married to the Ri HaZoken. Rav Yehuda ben Yitzchok's yeshiva in Paris produced such notables as Rav Moshe of Kusi, the author of the Smag, Sefer Mitzvos Gedolos, Rav Yitzchok ben Moshe of Vienna, the author of the Or Zeruah, who often quotes him in their works. Because of his special piety, he was also known as Rav Yehuda Chosid, the pious. and is quoted by that name, it would seem, in Tosfos and Bava Metzia, in Hey Amud Beis in 5b. The Tosfos of Yehuda Chosid on Brachos, as well as other Masechtas, were also authored by him, and are often quoted in the Tosfos that is printed in our Gemaras. The Baal Tosfos, as Rabbi Yehuda of Paris, Rabbi Yehuda Chosid, is often confused with his contemporary, Rabbi Yehuda Chosid ben Shmuel of Regensburg, Germany, who is the author of the Sefer Hasidim and the Tzavos, Rabbi Yehuda Chosid, the last will and testament of Rabbi Yehuda Chosid of Regensburg. But it would seem that the Tosfos is quoting the Rabbi Yehuda of Paris, who was the famous teacher of the school of the Baalei Tosfos. It would seem that the appellation Chosid, the pious one, is confirmed by the quote that we have on page 6, on note 2 of paragraph A. This is a Tosfos taken from Shabbos and Kuf Tes Zayin Amud Beis 116b, and is quoted in Shulchan Aruch. And it says, Miu Osun Mochomas Aksuvim Belaz, those war stories that are written in non-Jewish language. Miru L'Rabbeinu Yehuda, so Rabbeinu Yehuda would seem to Osur L'Ayin Bohem, it's forbidden to look into them. The Le'Gora, it is not worse. Mohod Sanya B'Perek Shoel, it's not worse than that which we learn in the Brisa in the chapter Shoel and Shabbos, Kufmim Tesom et Alpha 149a. Ksav Shetachas Hatsura V'Haduk Nois Osir Likrus V'Hem B'Shabbos. One is not allowed to read not only secular documents, business documents, but also writing which serves no important purpose. If one looks at a statue, a monument, one is not allowed to read the writing below it on Shabbos. Shabbos is a day which is spent in the study of Torah, or at least when it comes to reading other areas, it's something that advances a person's scientific knowledge, according to the halacha, makes one a better person. But just reading for curiosity was forbidden under the general prohibition of reading non-sacred documents. And he continues on, Vafilu b'chol lo yodas zri, as Rabbeinu Yehuda, does not know, even in the weekdays, mi hiter, who allowed Jews to read, you know, war novels? The Havalei Kamoshev Leitzim. Because it's involving in these non-positive activities is the equivalent of the Moshev Leitzim, one sitting in the amongst the scoffers, those who do not devote their lives to positive endeavors. So according to the Yehuda of Paris, it would seem that, you know, that one should really refrain from spending his time in areas where one does not really advance his intellect or his character. All based on this Moshev Leitzim. So we see the appellate Chosid, you know, is very well placed. And another very interesting area that affects our lives, again, which Rabbeinu Yehuda has quoted, has to deal with the idea of washing by meals. We know when we wash before bread, we say a bracha, or a benediction, al netilas yadayim. At the end of the meal, before we bench, before we say the grace after meals, the Birchas HaMazon, we also, it's a custom by many people, to wash again. This is called Mayim Achronim. The purpose is twofold. One is, if the hands are dirty, it is not in the dignity of the bracha that one should say a bracha with hands that are not clean. But even if the hands are clean, at least in Talmudic times, there was a concern that the hands came in contact with Melech Sodomus, a form of salt which was very fine, that if one would not wash it off, if a person by his normal usage would put it close to his eye, it would be an eye irritant. The purpose, therefore, is preventive. And he explains, this is on note 4 on page 6, Ubahalochas Gedolos Pirish Arishonim. Pirish is the Halochas Gedolos, this is the word, the Gaonic work, explains the Rishonim, the first water, those we wash before eating bread, Shehem Mitzvah, Mishum Srach Truma, they're a mitzvah because they're an enlargement of the original demand that a Kohen ritually wash his hands before eating. As an enlargement of that, all Jews wash their hands before eating bread. That demands a bracha, to unin bracha. Avachronim, the latter washing, Shehem Letzorach Odom, there for the purpose of the enhancement of the man himself, Mishum Melech Sodomus, because of this fear of this fine salt, ain tunin bracha. This is what the Baal Halachas Gedolos wrote. And the Tosfos continues on, as the Tosfos in Chulin, Kuf Hei Omed Aleph, in 105a, Mikan Kosov Rabbeinu Yehuda Beperek Bamem Adlikim B'Tosvosov, that Rabbeinu Yehuda in his own Tosfos that he wrote as a commentary to the second chapter of the tractate Shabbos, She'ein Levorach Al Kriya Shema Shelefnei Mitosov, before one goes to bed at night, one is required to say the Shema. This is a protection for the person. But since it's only a preventive, one does not make the bracha Asher Kedishon Mitzvoisa V'Tzivonu Likra Shema. We don't make the bracha that we're commanded to say the Shema, because it is really only a preventive, a protective measure, rather than it in its own right is important. In the year 1224, Rabbi Yehuda of Paris died. He was succeeded by his disciple and son-in-law, Rabbi Yechiel of Paris. Rabbi Yechiel attracted hundreds of disciples. Amongst his most famous were his son-in-law, Rabbi Yitzchak of Kerbel, the author of the Smach, Sefer Mitzvos Ketanos, as we pointed out before, a compendium of mitzvahs that apply in our own time, and Rabbeinu Peretz of Kerbel, the author of the Tosfos Rabbeinu Peretz on many tractates of the Talmud. As we stated before, Rabbi Yitzchak and Rabbeinu Peretz were also students of Rav Moshe and Rav Shmuel of Evra. Rav Meir of Rottenburg, who in his time was the most famous leader of German Jewry, was also a disciple of his. And on page 6 in our notes, we quote the Tosfos of Yuma, Daf Yud Ches Omid Beis, which was authored by the mayor of Rottenburg, who he quotes, Ki Shamaiti, says, I heard, B'Shem Moiri Harbeni Yechiel Mepariz, I heard in the name of my master of Yechiel of Paris, and he goes on to explain. Throughout these years, the Jews were the subject of harassment and persecution. In the year 1239, a new chapter of persecution began for French Jewry. In that year, an apostate Jew by the name of Nicholas Donin of La Rochelle, France, came to Pope Gregory IX. As you remember, as I said this in a previous lecture, Gregory was the one who officially sanctioned the Inquisition and allowed burning by the stake as the punishment for heretics. Donin claimed that the Talmud is full of anti-Christian propaganda and poses a threat to Christianity and therefore should be burned. On March 3, 1240, in a massive coordinated attack, all Hebrew literature that they could get hold of was seized by the church while the Jews were davening, praying in their synagogues. On the 12th of June of that year, in the presence of the French royal court, a church inquiry was opened in Paris to decide the merits of Donin's claims. Four of the most prestigious rabbis of France, Rav Yechiel of Paris, Rav Moshe of Kusi, the author of the Sefer Mitzvos Gedolos, Rav Shmuel ben Shlomo of Falej, who was also one of the mentors of the mayor of Rothenburg, and Rabbi Yehuda ben Dovid of Melun. To understand the accusations leveled by Nicholas Donin against the Talmud, and the position that Rabbi Yechiel of Paris and his colleagues took in its defense, please turn to your handout on page 7. In the handout, we quote first from a Mishnah in Sanhedrin Mem Gimel Amud Aleph in 43a. There it's referring to the laws of capital punishment, specifically to one of the punishments is sekila, stoning. And after they go through the process of interrogating the witnesses, motzalo zechus, if they found a merit, if there's some doubt, supotru, they free the man, because they could not make a conviction unless they were totally convinced. By the way, there's a Mishnah in Makkos and Zion Amud Aleph that says a Sanhedrin that killed once in 7 years was considered a Sanhedrin of murderers. Vim lov, but if they can't find any doubt, yotzeli sokel, the man is taken out to be stoned. Ukruz yotzel afonov, and an announcement goes out before him to the general populace, telling the details. Ish ploni ben ploni yotzeli sokel, this person, the son of that person, is going out to be stoned. Al shovra vera plonis, because he violated this particular crime. Uploni of ploni edov, and this person, that person, are his witnesses. Komishu edele zechus, anyone who knows some merit, some means of casting doubt, yovoi v'yalamado, should come and express it. That's the Mishnah. The Gemara continues, Omar Abaye v'tzarch lameimer, in addition, part of the pronouncement is b'yom ploni, b'sho plonis, describing the crime, what day and what hour of the day what it occurred, v'mokam ploni, on which place, Dilma ika diyadi v'asu mazim lahu, because maybe there are people who know what occurred during that time, and realize that those witnesses who claim that they were present at that time in that place were not there, but actually somewhere else. And people who are aware of that should come forward, the osiv mazim lahu, and they will go and contradict. Will show that these witnesses actually perjured themselves. The Gemara continues on to explain the kruz yotze lefonav. The pronouncement was made after the whole judicial process, and after the person was condemned, and after the person is about to be taken out to be stoned. At that moment, the proclamation is made. Lefonavin mikoralo. But originally, there was no proclamation. In all probability, since it's so hard to get a conviction anyway, if there had been a proclamation, the person's name would have been besmirched, and really to no avail. Whereas afterwards, after the conviction was made, and in all probability, it's such so rare to get a conviction that the evidence was irrefutable. At that point, as a last gasp effort, there is this proclamation, but not before. And the Gemara goes on, and this part of the Gemara we no longer have. I mean, it is in scholarly works, but is not in the standard Talmud that is printed, because it was taken out by the church. And it's this section which was the major focus of the debate between the four Bali Tosvos and Nicholas Donin in the church. And it asks, Votanya, we learned in a brisa, the Erev Pesach Tolul Yeshu HaNotzri. There was a man called Yeshu HaNotzri who was hanged. And this, the hanging we're described is not killing by crucifixion. After a person was stoned, and this is towards nightfall, momentarily the person is put on a pole, and he's publicly displayed and immediately taken off and buried. And Yeshu HaNotzri was hanged, in other words, his corpse was put up, and this was the eve of Passover. In other words, he was stoned, and his corpse was lifted on this pole on the eve of Passover. Vakruz Yetzlofonov Arboyim Yoim, and 40 days before he was actually killed, there was a public proclamation, Yeshu HaNotzri Yotze Lisokel, Yeshu HaNotzri is going out to be stoned, Al Shekishev, Behisis Vihidiach Es Yisrael, because he performed witch sorcery, and he lured Jews privately, the Tisis Vihidiach, publicly, to lure them to idolatry. Kol Mishe Edele Zechus Yovav Yelamed Olav. Anyone knows any merit for him should come and speak up on his behalf. There was no merit to be found, but Talu Berim Pesach, and they hung him up on the eve of Passover. The Gemara responds to this question, because it would seem that that would be the normative procedure, and therefore that the hanging is done, and the punishment after 40 days of prior proclamation, and this goes against our Mishnah. Omar Ula, so the great Amora Ula answered the Tisbra, says, "What do you think? Yeshu Anotzi Barafuchi Sechusu, was Yeshu Anotzi a man that the laws of going that extra mile, of trying to find some merit in his case, that for such a person we would go through that effort? Maces who? He is a person who was convicted of the overwhelming evidence of being someone who lured a Jew or Jews to worship idols. Rachmona Omer lo sachmo v'sechas olav. Then one should have no compassion over such a person. And therefore, this last gasp effort, which is really rachmanis, which is really an act of compassion, would not be done in such a case. So why would they make this cruise the proclamation in any case, before or after? Elishaini Yeshu. Yeshu is a different case entirely. The Korv L'Malchus Haba. He was a man who was close to the government, and the government would not allow the Sanhedrin, the Jewish court of law, to kill him unless special measures were taken. The Gemara goes on, which is not germane to our discussion now, describing his Yeshu's disciples. They had five disciples, and how they were put to death. But this Gemara continues on and is complemented by another Gemara in Sanhedrin further on, in Kuf Zayin Amud Beis in 107b. And here the Gemara deals with another issue. How a teacher should deal with a student. Tana Rabbonim, the rabbis taught, Le'olam te smoil doicha v'min mikarevis. The left hand, the weaker hand, should push away, should discipline. The Amin, the right hand, the stronger hand, Makarevis, should bring up a student closer. And quotes cases in history where this rule was violated, and there were terrible results. Loi ka Elisha, one should not be like Elisha, the prophet, shedechofoi legechazi b'shtei yadayim, who pushed away his student, his disciple Gehazi, with both hands, and Gehazi became an idolater. And now this section, again, is not in the commonly published Talmud. Again, it's in the scholarly works. V'loi ki Yeshua ben Prachya, and not like Yeshua ben Prachya, dechofa liyeshu ha-notzri b'shtei yodav, who pushed, Yeshua ben Prachya was the leader of the Sanhedrin in the period after the Hanukkah revolt. Yeshua ben Prachya lived during a period of time when the government was persecuting the Rabbonim, the rabbinic, the rabbis, the Perushim, the Pharisees. You know, we're all familiar with the Hanukkah story and the five sons of Matisyahu. The last surviving son was Shimon. His son, whose name was Yochanan Hyrcanus, who originally in his reign was very close to the Rabbonim, the Pharisees. Later on in his reign, he became a Sadducee, a Tzaduki. And he went on to kill many of the rabbis, and the remaining rabbis fled. He is known in the Talmud not only by the term Yochanan, but also by the term Yanai. And with that, we can understand the passage of the Talmud. What was the story that Yeshua ben Prachya, Dechofa Yeshua Notzri, he pushed aside Yeshua Notzri with Bishtei Yodav, with his two hands. This is the same Yeshua HaNotzri. Yeshua ben Prachya Mahi. Kidikatlinu Yanai Malkun. When Yanai the king is referring to Yochanan, killed L'Rabbonon, also Yeshua ben Prachya, Yeshu L'Alexandria Shel Mitzrayim. They fled, Yeshua with his disciple, Yeshu, fled to Alexandria. This Yochanan Hyrcanus died in the year 104 before the Common Era. We don't know the year exactly when Yochanan attempted to kill the Rabbonim, but it was sometime before the year 104. In the year 103 before the Common Era, one of Yochanan's son, who was also called Yanai, came to power. Alexander Yanai, he's called. His brother-in-law, his wife's brother, was Shimon ben Shetach, who was the leading disciple of Yeshua ben Prachya. And it was through him that the rabbis eventually were allowed to come back and to exert their influence in Eretz Yisrael. And this is what the Talmud says, Ki haba shalma, when there was peace, Sholach le Shimon ben Shetach, sent to Alexander, Mini Yerushalayim ira kodesh, for me Yerushalayim, the holy city, Lechi Alexandria shel Mitzrayim, to you Alexandria, Achoisi, my sister, Baili Shorib Besoichech, my husband is living in your midst, referring to Yeshua ben Prachya, Vanoichi Yesheva Shemema, and I am sitting desolate. As a result, Yeshua ben Prachya got up. Also, he came, he went to Israel. Yisram Aleah Hushpiz, on the way, he came to an inn. Abdele Yakra Tuva, they treated him with great dignity. Omar, and he said to his Talmud Yeshu, Kama Yofach Sanyazel. The hostess is such a beautiful person, referring to the beauty of her character. Omar Le Rebbe. So he said, Rebbe, no, truth is, her eyes are round, she's not so beautiful. With that, Yeshua ben Prachya became incensed. Amalei Russia, evil one, B'kachat Isaac, this is what you're involved in. Apek Arba Mea Shipore V'Shamte, he took 400 shofros. In other words, there was a great act of excommunication, and he pushed him away, because he felt he was rotten to the core. Also, L'kame Kama Zimnen, many times afterwards, Yeshua Notzri came to Yeshua ben Prachya to ask forgiveness. Omer LeKablon, receive us. Receive me. V'havikah mashmich bei, mashkach bei. He gave no attention to him. Yom Echad, havikah kori kriya shema. One day, Yeshua ben Prachya was reciting Shema. Osu l'kame, Yeshua Notzri came before him. Sover l'kabule. At that moment, Yeshua ben Prachya thought, okay, I'll accept him. Achvilei biyodeh, he was saying Shema, Yeshua ben Prachya. So he made a motion with his hand. Hu sovar, but Yeshua Notzri interpreted this. Mitcha chadochim, he's pushing me again, away again. Ozel, he went, zokav leventa vishtachavulo. This is an expression, he erected a brick and bowed down to it. In other words, he began to worship idols, or whatever that means. Omerle, subsequently, Yeshua ben Prachya met him after he had created a whole movement. But Hador Boch, repent. Omerle, Kach Mekublani Mimcha, I received this teaching from you. Kolachote El Machdi Esarabim, anyone who sins and causes others to sin, Ema Speakim Biyad Elasas Tshuva. heaven, this Hashem, does not allow such a person to do tshuva, does not give the person the opportunity, and beyond redemption. And it continues on, V'omar Mar, and the Master said, commented, Yeshu kisha v'hisis v'dichas Yisrael. The Yeshu performed sorcery, and he lured Jews privately and publicly to idolatry. In this passage, we have a person who's called Yeshu HaNotzri. He seems to be very similar, in, at least in name, to Yeshu the Nazarene. He had disciples. And here Nicholas Donin pointed his finger and says, here we have clear evidence that the Jews are committing blasphemy against the founder of Christianity. Rabbi Yechiel of Paris and the other rabbis pointed out, though, that the whole time frame is of a person who couldn't have been the Yeshu HaNotzri of the New Testament. We're not speaking of Roman times. We're speaking of a man who lived in the year 90 before the Common Era. I mean, he left with his master Yeshua ben Prachya before the year 104. The Yeshu HaNotzri of the New Testament was killed around the year 30. There's a major discrepancy of time. This is a period where the Jews were in control of Eretz Yisrael, not the Romans. In addition, in the first citation, we state that Yeshu HaNotzri was core of Lamal, who's close to the government. The Yeshu HaNotzri of the New Testament was someone who had no connections. He was killed by the government, by the Romans. Despite their pleadings, and despite their arguments, the outcome was a foregone conclusion. The Talmud was condemned to be burned. On Friday the 17th of June, 1242, 24 cartloads of Svarim, copies of the Talmud and other related works, were publicly burned in Paris by the Dominicans. Donin also persuaded Pope Gregory IX to issue a papal bull that the Talmud be burned everywhere, and to establish censures and inquisitions over other Jewish writings. One of the kinos, the lamentations recited every year on Tisha B'Av, is Sha'ali Srufa Be'esh, composer of Mayor of Rottenburg, and dedicated to the tragedy of the burning of the Talmud. On page 8 of your handout, we quote several moving passages from that kina, that lamentation. Sha'ali Srufa Be'esh, O Torah that has been consumed by fire, seek the welfare of those who mourn over you, of those who yearn to dwell in the courtyard of your habitation, of those who gasp for breath as they lie in the dust of the earth, who are pained and are bewildered over the holocaust of your parchments. They grope in the dark, bereft of light. Indeed, they await daylight that will shine upon them and you. How was it that you, O Torah, given by God the consuming fire, should be consumed by the fire of mortals, that the heathens were not singed by your coals? Moreover, you, O Torah, even decreed the burning of your laws and statutes were given by fire. Therefore, fortunate is he who will requite you, in the language of Yishalom Loch Gemuleth, who will revenge you. As a result of that burning, the Talmud could only be studied by memory, by heart. There were no books or scrolls. The work of Rabbeinu Yitzchak Alfasi, the Rif, which is a summary of the Talmud, seems to have been allowed by the church authorities, because it contained no anti-Christian material, and that was studied. In fact, the rabbis of Evro wrote their Tosfos on the Rif summary and not on the Talmud. In all probability, this is because the Talmud could no longer be effectively studied in those days without the use of the original written material and the syllabus of the yeshiva during this period after the burning was the Rif. In a later period in Italy, after the year 1553, Once again, the Talmud was burned. At this point, it wasn't manuscripts, but it was actually the printed Talmud. And then again, a similar exception was made for the work of Rabbeinu Alfasi. We find commentators commenting on the Rif's work, but not on the Talmud itself, because for many years it was not extant. It was only after much money was given to the church authorities that the Jews again were allowed to republish the Talmud, but this was after they had taken out those sections. The sections in Sanhedrin and other places that the church felt was against their faith. In the midst of these difficulties and the worsening conditions of Jews in France, in the year 1259, Rabbeinu Yechiel, together with his son Rav Yosef and many of his disciples, emigrated to Eretz Yisrael. He settled in Acre, where he established the yeshiva Medrash HaGodol de Paris. In all probability, it was in that yeshiva that the Ramban delivered his drasha, his discourse on Rosh Hashanah, that was previously quoted. Rabbeinu Yechiel passed away in the year 1268, was buried at the foot of Mount Carmel, near the grave of Rabbeinu Shimshon. In conclusion, again, I would just like to go over the notes on page 9, again, to give you a sense of the continuity, the Shalshelas HaKabbalah, the chain of transmission of the Baalei Tosfos. Again, we had gone through this in the previous lecture. We begin with Rashi, who lived between 1040 and 1105, continued on to Rashi's disciples. Amongst them was Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir was the teacher and father of the Rashbam, or Shmuel ben Meir, or Beinu Tam, and Rivom. We've gone through Rabbeinu Tam's disciples. One of them was Rabbi Yitzchak of Dampir, who was also a nephew of Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Yitzchak of Dampir's disciples, amongst them was Rabbi Shimshon of Shantz, and also Rabbi Yitzchak ben Avram, amongst other great luminaries. Rabbi Yitzchak ben Avram's, who was the successor of Yitzchak of Dampir, and he lived from approximately 1145 to 1210, his most famous disciples, as we quoted before, is Rav Nosson ben Meir of Trinquetel, Rav Yehuda ben Yochar, are both masters of Ramban, Rav Moshe and Shmuel ben Shneir of Evrel, who were the masters of Rabbeinu Yonah, and also included in his yeshiva was Rabbeinu Yisrael Yehuda ben Yitzchok, who of course was a disciple previously of the Rihazoken, Rav Yitzchak Dampir. He lived, Rav Yehuda of Paris, lived between 1166 and 1224. His most famous disciples was Yechiel ben Yosef of Paris, who is his son-in-law and his successor, Rav Moshe of Kusi, who was the author of the Sefer Mitzvos Gedolos, Rav Yitzchak ben Moshe of Vienna, who was the author of the Or Zeruah. Rav Yitzchak ben Moshe will be discussed at length in a future lecture. Rav Yechiel ben Yosef of Paris' most famous disciples, and he lived between approximately 1190 and 1268, was Rav Yitzchak ben Yosef of Korbel. This is the author of the Sefer Mitzvos Katanos. Rabbeinu Peretz ben Yitzchak HaKohen of Korbel, who was the author of the Tosfos Rabbeinu Peretz, and Rabbeinu Meir ben Boruch of Rothenburg. Again, he will be the subject of a future lecture. In the next lecture, I would like to speak about the great Torah giants of Germany. Our focus up until now, last lectures, was France. Many of the great Baalei Tosfos and great authors of famous halachic works came from Germany. Germany developed a whole school of Hasidim, of devout pietists, whose major figure was Yehuda HaChassid of Regensburg, the author of the Sefer Hasidim. And this will be the subject of the next lecture. Now, are there any questions?
Yeah, the question of these 24 cartloads, to what extent does this This, it would seem, was meant really within France, where Louis the Ninth had power. It was virtually every volume of the Talmud. The Talmud was very rare. It was very expensive. Generally, individuals didn't have it in their bookshelves. It was in synagogues. It was in yeshivas. Basically, they were held in libraries. One could go and learn them. Perhaps one could borrow a volume and bring it back. But it virtually was all that was extant. You have to realize they did this not just on their own, for the help of apostates, you know, people who knew Jewish life and knew where these things would be. And since it was done without warning, there was very little chance. That which was saved was saved by happenstance, not by plan. So it was dealt a terrible blow to the Jews in France. And the question of importing it now from other areas in the light of a church that was committed for its destruction was very difficult. There were individual, the question, how do we know what was censored? There were individual volumes of the Talmud, as well as, at least there's an extant manuscript of the entire Talmud, which was called the Munich manuscript, which was Ksav Yad Minchen, which preserved the entire those sections, and it was reconstructed from that which was in preserved. Let me just put it this way: in terms of putting it back, and there is virtually no printing of the Talmud done anymore. Everything is just our lithographs, our prints of the Talmud. That which was printed beforehand, of course, doesn't have it. So really, it's rare to have where we find it as a. It's rare to find like a printed edition that you have. There are separate works called Thesaurus Hashas, which have been printed, which have all the, you know, the censored versions. And there are some editions that will have it on the side. The question about the Talmud that came from Syria and the like, that would be a possibility they would have contained, but it seems that the more or less that everything that was, at least in the modern era, either came from the printing presses of Europe or the copies of the printing presses of Europe. So we're not. We don't have extant volumes from that, from the Sephardic lands. So the question was, you know, why do the Jews keep on staying in Europe, or they stayed until they're actually thrown out physically? You know, there's. I guess the best answer to this. I mean, we do find, of course, that Jews emigrated. You see the grand. And through much of the period, we find Jews emigrating to Poland, but the masses of Jews stayed intact. Well, it would probably be called the Willie Sutton principle. Willie Sutton was a very famous bank robber in the 50s. And they once asked him, says, why do you rob banks? And he answered, because that's where the money is. There were tremendous economic opportunities for Jews in Europe, at least that they felt so. For them to emigrate to a new land, where, which was really on the decline economically. It was really Europe is where there was economic growth, Western Europe. At that time already they had fallen into decline, Northern Africa, this is the lands of the East, that there was a tremendous reluctance for Jews to emigrate to this. I mean, when they're forced, they were forced, but on their own there was reluctance.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.